Hello, I'm Tom Weber. Thanks for downloading the Counter Stories podcast. Today, we're bringing you a bonus episode. It's a conversation I had with Michelle Norris, a former host for NPR and a Minneapolis native, about a project she's worked on for almost 8 years now called the Race Card Project, which explores race and identity, six words at a time. Here's that conversation. Tom Weber on NPR News. Want to talk about race and identity? Well, for many people, the answer is no. But what if we limited you to six words? In an age when pages, books are written about identity politics, race and racism, before and after the Trump era, the ways that race informs every topic of discussion or should inform it, what good would six words do? Well, journalist Michelle Norris has some thoughts on that. She's a familiar voice and name for public radio listeners, the former host of NPR's All Things Considered. She left NPR a few years ago. She works on what's called the Race Card Project, which has won a prestigious Peabody Award. It also explores race and identity, and what a time to be doing that. It's also now part of a program through the Aspen Institute. And don't forget, Michelle Norris, Minnesota native, went to Washburn High. Michelle, welcome, and go Millers.
Thank you, Tom. So good to be with you. Great to be on NPR, because I still listen through the computer to NPR.
Do you? You want to know what's going on in Minnesota, huh?
I do. It makes me feel like I'm still home.
It's a beautiful fall day here, but we might have snow on Friday, so.
That does not surprise me. Snow before Halloween. That's
exactly.
Unusual there.
Yes. The blizzard, of course. Everyone remembers the Halloween blizzard. This started when? 2012? This is 5 years?
It's seven years. Going into soon our, well, really now into our eighth year. It started in 2010.
It seems like after 7, 8 years of doing this, especially this concept around six words, that you have a pretty good sample of where you've seen conversations around, the hard conversations, right? We talk about the hard conversations, and how those have evolved in those 7 to 8 years. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it certainly is deeper than it was when we started. I created this because I wrote a book about my family's complex racial legacy, including things I learned that I didn't know when I was growing up in the south side of Minneapolis, that suddenly the elder black folks in my family started talking about what it was like to live in a very different America, a Jim Crow America that existed in some way even in Minnesota, where we pride ourselves on tolerance. And I knew when I went out to write to talk about that book after writing it that I would be engaged with people who I thought didn't want to talk about race. So that's where the six-word concept came from, is to provide something like an invitation for people to lean into the conversation. And at the beginning, it was almost like a lot of the submissions were like rainbows and bunnies.
Yeah.
There's only one race, the human race.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of people would quote Rodney King, can't we all just get along? Or why can't we all just get along? Mm-hmm. And then they started to get deep pretty fast, though, when we created a website where we could post what was coming in the inbox. And I think through modeling, that's how it started to get deep. And people would, you know, you'd think, what could you possibly say in six words? Well, things you don't hear in polite conversation all the time. White, not allowed to be proud. I'm only Asian when it's convenient. And when we put things like that out there, people, I guess, understood the rules of engagement. Oh, it's that kind of conversation? Mm-hmm. I get to fully unburden myself. I get to speak my truth and attach my name to it. And no one's going to bark at me or call me an idiot or a racist or say I'm intolerant. I get a space to say this. And then it got really deep. And if you look at the website now, You see, on page after page, entry after entry, the kinds of things that you generally don't hear people say out loud and attach their name and their picture. And so the conversation has definitely evolved. But in the past, Tom, in the past 18 months, I would say, we've started to see something that's a little bit different and perhaps reflects the times. We've always had a very large number of submissions from white Americans, and that's somewhat unusual in a conversation about race, because oftentimes conversations or programs around race are aimed at the as-of-now minority population in America.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last 18 months or so, we started to see submissions come from people who were white Americans who felt like they were just tired of race. from white Americans who felt that they faced a certain degree of discrimination in America at this moment. And from white Americans, and particularly white men, who felt invisible and felt that the world had in some ways moved on or was not concerned with their interests or their concerns or their wants or their needs. And that was something that we really hadn't seen, at least in large numbers, at the beginning of the project. And so in some ways, the project is a wonderful tool for dialogue, but it can also be a bit of a barometer.
Did you know that in the moment? Because what you just described has been raised as a factor in the messaging Donald Trump did and why he won. If you saw that happening 18 months ago, did you pick up on it, or did you miss it just like so many other journalists, Michelle?
Well, you know, I'm not going to be that person who claims that I had perfect 2020 vision. I mean, I did see it coming in, and I did raise it. I mean, I noted that the political winds were moving in a particular direction, and I saw that Donald Trump was picking up on that, and that what we were seeing in the inbox was mirroring what was happening in the rallies, you know, that he was holding and in the messaging that he was doing. We actually did see that. You know, you don't ever want to be the person who said, "I told you so," because no one likes that person.
Right.
But we did. We definitely picked it up.
So I want to throw it out to the audience here, to you listening. What would be your six words? Maybe you've actually participated in this. If you just search the Race Card Project, the website's very easy to use. You can submit your own six words. You can submit a photo. It's presented there online. What would be your six words as we have this conversation? 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can tweet me at WeberTom1 as well. And don't call or text if you're driving. It seems to me the six-word thing, Michelle, I mean, we've heard the jokes, especially you and I. You know, when you're in a profession that relies so much on writing, you hear the jokes or the maybe even quotes. I think maybe Mark Twain talks about this. You know, if you have to speak for an hour, you know, you spend 10 minutes preparing. If you have to speak for 2 minutes, you spend 4 hours preparing. If you have to talk for 30 seconds, it takes you 6 hours, right? Because you have such little time, and you have to edit yourself so much. Is that part of why the six words works in your mind?
I think it works because it forces you to put a fine point on it. You have to distill it. It's reductive. You have to distill it down to the thing that is most important to you. I always tell people, don't overthink it. Don't spend 6 hours. it's sort of first thought, best thought. The thing that pops in your mind is usually, if you did spend 6 hours, is the thing that you would go back to. And as a writer, it's a useful exercise for me. I mean, I knew that the six-word concept was familiar for a while ago. There was Six Words Minneapolis. I don't know if you remember that. And there was, you know, all kinds of six-word exercises. But I also know as a writer that when I'm trying to tackle something difficult, to this day, I try to reduce it to one sentence. And if I can't reduce it to one sentence, I feel like I have not yet tackled it. So I know that it can work, particularly when taking on something that's prickly and difficult, and in doing it in just six words, you have to focus on the element of the story that's most important to you. What's the verb that really meant the most to you? What is that, just that one thing? So instead of it taking a lot of time, I think it's more it's an instinctive act.
Has it been introspective, or has it been commentary on the state of affairs? We're looking right now at a moment about protesting police brutality during NFL football games, or at the start of NFL football games. We're talking about tweeting out comments by a president against a black member of Congress and a black widow whose husband died under still completely unknown circumstances in Niger, Charleston, mm-hmm. white supremacy. Are those specific events trickling down into the six words, or is it still very circumspect to the person?
It's more refractive. I mean, it's interesting because I noted that it's a barometer, and we, you know, after Trayvon Martin, we saw a large surge of submissions. We see certain things that are reflected in the inbox, but for the most part, people are writing about the lived experience of race from a very personal point of view. So while people may not write directly about the Tiki Torch Parade in Charlottesville, or they might not write directly about taking a knee, or they might not write directly about you know, a particular incident. They write about we see an uptick in submissions around those incidents, but usually people are writing about their own perspective because you only get 6 words. So instead of talking about what happens when Colin Kaepernick takes a knee, you're talking about what that elicits in you. So you might write about patriotism instead of writing about what happened in Charlottesville and the tragedy and you know, with the car and the torches and the chanting. And what people might focus on instead is the notion of being replaced, which is one of the things they chanted when they were marching on the UVA campus. We will not be replaced. So it's an interesting barometer. It's not a direct barometer. And I think that, oddly, that's part of the value of this in the moment and perhaps in the future when people try to reach back and understand this moment. Historians will naturally go to those events that you mentioned, but harder is to understand. What's harder to understand is how that resonated in people's lives and the ripples that that creates. That's where social change happens. That's where attitudes shift or not. And that's what we're able to mine. And I should say one other thing. You know, you've been talking about Twitter and asking people to participate in the conversation and you know, in a true Minnesota fashion, telling them not to tweet or text while they're driving.
Yes, of course.
But this is something that surfaced at almost the perfect moment because of social media, because people are used to saying profound things in short bursts mm-hmm. on Facebook and on Twitter. And the rules around privacy evolved also. So when we first started, we asked for people's names, and that was it. And mea culpa here, I admit that I didn't like the idea of including faces because I thought it would... I was thinking about the aesthetic of the website, and I thought it would look messy, and I was so wrong. Because when you look on the website and you see this multitude of faces which represents America in all its multicultural wonder, it's so interesting to see that. But I think that one of the reasons that people are more willing to share their stories, more willing to attach their name, more willing to send in a picture or an artifact and fully claim that is because people are used to doing that. They shout their anthems now with their thumbs mm-hmm. on Facebook and Twitter and Reddit and all kinds of other things.
Michelle Norris is with me, who used to be a host on All Things Considered, which if you're a big public radio fan, you'll know Michelle's name for sure. Also, Minneapolis native here as well, so it's good to have her back on the air here on Minnesota Public Radio. We're asking you for your 6 words as well as she talks about this project she's been doing now for nearly 8 years. 1-800-242-2828. Bob in Minneapolis, do you have your 6 words, Bob?
I do.
Go
we
for
started
it.
Racist and still are.
We started racist and still are. That's very profound. Where did that just come to you as we put out the call?
I mean, it's evident. It's our society was built on, and our economy was built on slavery. The stain is still there. Heard your interesting, very interesting and also disconcerting piece on the shackled legacy with higher education institutions. And I mean, it's if you're not a misanthrope, you're not paying attention, would be what I would say.
Bob, thanks so much for the call there. I appreciate it. Michelle, what all these years later, what are the two or three that just floored you when you read them?
Well, I you know, I appreciate, first of all, thanks to Bob for sharing that. And it's a sentiment that's not shared by everybody. Mm-hmm. You know, we really in America don't have a full understanding of our history and our founding. I've said this over and over again, that America is the home of the brave and the land of amnesia. We really don't, many Americans don't understand the reality of slavery as it existed and what happened when slavery was eradicated by law, but how in many cases it continued in other forms and how the vestiges still live with us today. So I really appreciate him sharing that. There are some cards that landed in the inbox that just hit my heart or tickled my imagination. One is Black Babies Cost Less to Adopt.
Whoa.
Hard to even say that out loud, isn't it?
Wow. I mean, you have to think about the story that person's life had to type those words.
Well, the original, and it turned out that we've received more than a few submissions that explore this same topic. And in fact, I wound up doing a radio piece on one of those and spent some time profiling a family in Minnesota. They had adopted two young black children. But the original submission came from a woman. She only gave us her first name. She lived in Covington, Louisiana. She had adopted an African-American child when he was young. And as he got older and started to ask about the circumstances of his adoption, she understood that he would come to see and perhaps understand that in America's adoption system, there is a sliding scale. And she said costless. You don't buy babies, but there's a fee attached to the adoption process. And for families that want to open their home and their hearts to children, they, you know, it can be quite expensive. And we researched this and discovered that, in fact, if you want to adopt a white child, it is much more expensive in terms of the fee structure than it is if you want to adopt a child of color. And within the children of color, black girls, the fee structure is slightly higher than for black boys, and skin color plays into it. And Latino children have sort of one rate associated with them, and black children have a separate rate. And when we discovered this, it was just, you know, it is in some ways it reflects something perhaps altruistic, because there are fewer families of color that participate in the adoption process, and some of it is meant to provide an incentive so that more people will be willing to open their homes and their hearts. But it also, in some fundamental and really disturbing way, reflects our value system.
So are we matching the conversations? Are the conversations that you're hearing on public radio or on Facebook or on cable news or wherever you find conversations about race, do those match the conversations that seem to be screamed for when you read these six-word entries, when you think about them as a whole?
What do you mean by match? I just want to make sure I understand.
The six words you just read about black babies cost less to adopt, I mean, it seems to me like there's an element of conversations about race that sparks that I don't hear.
Oh.
You know what I mean? Like,
yes,
like,
now I understand. Yeah.
Public radio or whoever's going to have conversation 1, 2, and 3 about race, but what you're seeing on the Race Card Project is that people actually want to talk about 4, 5, and 6.
Right. It's a taproot is what it is. It goes deep into areas that we don't explore in public spaces, and in some cases goes deeper even than the kinds of conversations that people have with comfort in, you know, at their kitchen table or in the locker room or in the place where you let down your hair and you're with the people that you're comfortable with, so you can say it like it is or tell it like it is. So it in some ways it does reflect the conversations that are happening, but it's also, you know, a sub rosa conversation. I mean, I'll share another one with you. This came from a fellow who lives in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and his six words were, "I don't care about blacks anymore." And again, if you go to the website and if you look at the website, you know, if you again and again see things, you don't hear people say that out loud. He might say that behind closed doors, but, you know, he's attached his name. He tells us he lives in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and he says, "I'm going to come out and say it, the same thing thousands, probably millions of people in this country are feeling at this point. I don't care about black people's problems anymore." And he says, don't get me wrong, he knows black people, he knows Asians, he knows Latinos, and he cares about them as much as every other human being on earth. But he says he can no longer care about this special set of issues that many black people hold so near and dear. And he goes on, and it's a fairly long essay that he provides, but he's tired as a white American man of feeling like every time he tries to enter the conversation, he always has to walk through a door labeled guilt or a door labeled shame or a door labeled it's my fault. And there's a certain amount of fatigue attached to that for him. So he cares a lot about the people he knows personally, but in general, either politically or socially, he has something that is akin to race fatigue and doesn't want to talk about the issue because he feels like it doesn't move forward. So I appreciate so much that he says that out loud and he gives us the trust that he feels like he can say it out loud on our website. And I tell people, if you go to the website and if you go to the inbox and if you look at the archive, you will experience something that might make you nod in agreement, but also you will experience things and meet people that that might offend you. And I actually think there's value in that, because even if you don't agree with someone, I believe deep in my bones that there's value in trying to understand where they come from, that there's value in trying to understand how they gained that or earned that perspective. And not with the goal of trying to agree with them, not with the goal of trying to bring people together so they all sing in the same octave. That's never going to happen in America. But at a point where we are so divided and where we often talk at each other instead of to each other, and where we are part of this big, large symphony where everyone is has the ability to speak their truth, we seem to place so much more of a value on what we say as opposed to what we hear, or to have opportunities to listen to someone that you don't agree with. And this is something that, even in this political moment, you know, we're in a very partisan moment. Politicians pay a price if they reach across the aisle. Activists sometimes can pay a price if they reach across the aisle. Mm-hmm. And people might feel like they know someone because they friended them or they understood what they said on social media, but have you actually listened to them to understand their life and how they gain that perspective? And if anything, I hope that this crazy project can provide a window or a bridge, and that's the name of the program that yeah. you know, I run at Aspen now, is a bridge, so a durable, sturdy social cultural bridge, so that people can walk back and forth metaphorically across that bridge and understand another culture and another way of thinking.
Michelle Norris with me. We're talking about the Race Card Project that I just tweeted out a link to. So if you follow me on WebertTom1, you can submit your own 6 words. Christine on Twitter said her 6 words: Integrated All-Black Mississippi School, 1968. That sounds like an amazing story, Christine. I hope you'll contact me. I'd love to hear more about that story. Let's go to the phones here. Brenda in Woodbury. Brenda, what are your 6 words?
Raising black grandsons, please keep safe.
Thank you so much, Brenda. Shirley in Minneapolis, what would you add? What would be your 6?
You'd understand if you were black.
Susan in St. Joseph, what would you say are your 6?
Where are my black childhood friends?
Thank you, Susan. Mark in Minneapolis, what are your 6?
Respect before pride, build beloved community.
Mark, thank you. Ruthie in Wadena.
Hi. I just started listening, so I don't know if this applies, but you can make it apply, I think, because it's about the people with power who make decisions for the powerless. And my 6 words are warmonger, but your child, but my child, not yours.
Ruthie, thanks so much. And Jim in northern Wisconsin, what would be your 6?
One human life equals one human life.
Thanks so much, Jim. Michelle, what are you reflecting on as you heard through? I wanted to spin through a few and just get a couple out there. I don't know if that's the normal mode that you do it, because for you it comes in a lot on the website, but I just threw a bunch at you there at once.
And Minnesota just always represents so well. I mean, it's amazing that you had so many people from so many areas in Minnesota and Wisconsin so quickly come up with so many profound stories. And in those stories, you see the different kinds of submissions that we get. So some people are talking about a world they want to see. Some people are talking about a world that they remember, integrated Mississippi school, 1968. Where are my black childhood friends? Some people are asking people to think in perhaps a different way you'd understand if you were black. And in that moment, Tom, you get a sense of what it's like for us every day when we go to the inbox and see these stories wash over us. You know, there's one thing I will note is most of these stories that you just that we just heard in the roll call were about race, but sometimes the stories aren't about race. And I have to tell you that if I were doing it again, I'm not sure I would call it the Race Card Project.
Oh, really?
I mean, I called it the Race Card Project because I was trying to turn a phrase I didn't like and turn it on its head.
The race card.
Because usually when people say someone, I mean, you no doubt have heard this.
Sure.
Maybe someone has said it to you. Oh, you're playing the race card. And that usually is a polite way of saying, could you please stop talking? You're making me uncomfortable. Or you're taking this conversation in a direction that, you know, I didn't anticipate. So I wanted to turn it on its head, and I called it the Race Card Project because I was trying to be pithy, and I thought that this would be a way to stoke conversation instead of shut it down. But from the very beginning, we realized that a lot of the submissions that came in did not have to do with race in the traditional sense. They weren't about skin color necessarily. So people are talking about what it's like to have been raised in an immigrant household, to be German in Minnesota or the Dakotas or somewhere, anywhere in America after World War I or World War II. What it was like to be raised as an immigrant who was Irish in a certain part of Pennsylvania where the phrase was, if you ain't Dutch, you ain't much. you know, and something I hadn't heard before. People write in often about having red hair and how the world views them because they have red hair. And for women, sometimes it means they're highly sexualized. I'm sorry to say that, but I've learned that that is something that a lot of people experience. Or for men, they talk about, in some cases, you know, the word ginger might be used as a term of endearment, but that is does not feel good all the time for people who are on the receiving end, or people who quite literally feel like they weren't eligible for a job because of the perceived temperament attached to them because they had red hair. People talking about having accents. Members of the military coming back to America, and no matter what box they check on the census, feeling like they're in a separate cohort forevermore because of what they experienced in a theater of war. And so this is very much an exploration of America's cultural DNA, not just its racial DNA. And every day I go on the inbox, I learn something that I didn't know, and it's been more valuable to me than any newsroom or any classroom that I've ever been in.
What, in our final minute or so here, Michelle, what comes of this? Where does this go from here in terms of, I don't know, maybe it's not part of the mission statement, but if you have all these six-word sentences, is there a place where it leads to a solution or fixing the problem somehow?
Well, you know, it's not a panacea, but we hope it is a toolbox that people can use. So we have worked with more than 24 universities who use this as a way to stoke dialogue or to create a space where students can talk and talk to each other and better understand each other and sort of excavate issues that might not be apparent because there are a lot of hidden narratives that surface. We are working with elementary schools and high schools. We get hundreds of submissions every month where teachers are using this in their classroom in some ways to create the scaffolding for dialogue, but also to explore history because there's all kinds of historic narratives that surface in the Race Card Project. We work with now municipalities and businesses. And my hope is, we also do several media partnerships, and you know, as a journalist, that means a lot to me.
Right.
And my hope is, in the long run, you know, I mentioned this before, is 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now, historians, journalists, researchers will look back at this moment because we're turning a page economically, we're turning a page technologically, we're turning a page demographically in this era between Barack Obama and Donald Trump, and try to understand what was going on in America, right. And this will be very useful.
Michelle, thanks so much for your time. It's so interesting. I tweeted out a link as well, so I hope you get more submissions in the inbox. And thanks so much for your time. It's always good to talk to you.
Tom, it's great to talk to you. My best to you.